morning, everyone. I'm Justin Smith. I'm the president of The Atlantic. Delighted to welcome everyone here to this morning's panel discussion from the Climate and Sustainability Track. It's entitled Collaboration Critical, and please join me in welcoming our moderator, David Monsma, who's the executive director of the Energy and Environment Program at the Aspen Institute.
Thank you, Justin. Welcome to Climate and Sustainability. The name of our session is Collaboration Critical. I'm here today to discuss the level of collaboration needed to move the needle on the dial on climate change and our response to it. Is Rhonda Zagaiki, the Vice President of Policy, Government, and Public Affairs for Chevron Corporation. Leslie, and I'm going to say
Doc.
Doc, because I'm always saying that. Executive Vice President of Corporate Affairs and Government Relations for Walmart Stores Incorporated. David Hawkins is the Director of Global and Domestic Sustainability. I got this wrong. Director of Climate Programs at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, who we all know. And Michael Northrup is the Program Director of Global and Domestic Sustainable Development Programs at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York City. Let me just start by saying that at the Aspen Institute, we certainly promote and agree with open and free exchange of ideas and thoughts. And in general, today, however, we're not going to debate the science of global warming and climate change. Rather, we're going to try to advance forward and look at the discussion about the goal here. If we, depending on the science that you read or you agree with, there is a need to address this climate change goal in terms of some science. Now, depending on the science that you agree with, there is some type of tipping point out there. It may be 450 parts per million of greenhouse gases of concentration level in the atmosphere. It may be 500, depending on if you talk to marine biologists and talking about acidification or other aspects of the atmosphere and the global climate system, there is a goal. Now, the question is, how do we interpret that for human activity? For our economic and our political processes that are going to need to align to address that. So I have a question to start off with here again is that if we're going to collaborate, it sounds to me as though we need agreement first. In order for the business sectors, the different industrial sectors to align, for states and federal governments, and for our own nation or society to dovetail with international efforts, there's going to have to be, to my mind, greater collaboration, more candid agreement, possibly more honesty about how we're going to do this. Frankly, our history on collaborating on the environment, on environmental goals as a society, has not been very good. So before we get started in talking about the different things that different sectors need to do, what communities, what businesses, what the oil and gas sector, what retail companies may be doing to contribute to this goal, what is the goal? And I'm going to turn to David Hawkins and ask him, whatever it takes, the legislation that's being discussed, the Lieberman-Warner bill that has a seemingly infinite stream of amendments, some positive, some poison pills. What is the goal now as we're talking about it in terms of our society trying to address this challenge of climate change and global warming?
Well, simply stated, the goal is agreeing on what we need to do. I would bounce off of the session that just ended in the big tent, literally and figuratively, and say that, you know, that presentation, if for those of you who listened to it, may have come across as daunting to possibly to the point of despair. I'm much more upbeat than that description. We should have started acting on global warming 20 years ago. So that makes the challenge more difficult that we didn't do that. But this is a solvable problem. And I agree with Jim Woolsey's comments that it doesn't require a Manhattan Project to get started on solving this problem. What we need to do is agree on the actions that need to be taken. And those actions will help move us toward the science-based goals. So what are those actions? Well, the reason that we need collaboration is that unlike a lot of environmental problems, global warming requires changing major sectors of economic activity. What are they? Well, power generation and transportation together result in two-thirds of global warming emissions in the United States and generally globally. So in those two areas, we've got two-thirds of the problem. power sector. What does it mean? We're going to have to change. We're going to have to build different kinds of power plants. The conventional kinds of power plants that are being built today, coal plants, natural gas fire plants, they're going to have to be different kinds of power plants. We're going to use different resources. We're going to use renewables, wind, solar, biomass, increasingly, to provide electric power. We're also going to have to deal with capturing carbon dioxide from the fossil fuel power plants, probably will continue to be built, and maybe even backfit some of the existing coal capacity around the world with technology to strip out the CO2. But they're going to be fundamentally different investments. In the area of efficiency, we are going to be able to buy time by having smarter appliances, by having better built buildings, by having industrial motors and other power-consuming activities that are designed to minimize their use of power per unit of work. We haven't designed those products in the past because electricity was cheap and because the environmental consequences of electricity were not well understood. Now we're getting to understand it, and we can define those objectives. In the transport sector, those of you who heard the presentation yesterday, we've basically got three big levers that we can pull on. One is more efficient vehicles. We haven't scratched the technical potential of what we can do with efficiency in the vehicle side. It's primarily an economic argument, and the economic actors have, up to now, been assuming that consumers won't pay for efficiency. And, of course, their stock prices are showing just how wrong that guess was. But this is not an immediate turnaround. And to make it sustainable, to make it sustained, we're going to need a policy that keeps that message in the forefront of the decision makers' minds. We're going to need a policy, and it probably means performance standards that are well designed to keep on driving efficiency to higher and higher levels on the vehicle side. And you heard some about the technical potential there. It's huge. And then the other thing we could do on the transportation side is change the fuels. And we'll probably talk with Rhonda about that later in this conversation. We're going to have less fossil petroleum inputs into the fuel system and more of non-fossil based systems, renewable biomass-based systems. And there's a challenge there in doing that sustainably and doing it in a way that doesn't have adverse land use impacts, but it is doable. And the third thing we can do is labeled smart growth. We can design our metropolitan areas to provide more transportation options so that we do not have to depend. We're not going to be convincing anybody, I think, in modern society to walk away from, literally or figuratively, from personal mobility in the form of private automobiles. But we can design metropolitan areas for options. We can create those options in the way we design those metropolitan areas and cut emissions there. So these are some of the big areas that are going to require activity. And because they cut so broadly across all of these different activities, and I haven't even mentioned agriculture yet, where we're going to have to incent practices that require less fossil fuel inputs to produce the food and grain and other products that we need. Techniques that build up the carbon in the soil. In order to do this, we're going to have some fundamental core agreement among the major economic players. And one of the things that we did to help move that ball along was to participate in the formation of what's called the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which is a pretty interesting innovation in policy, if you will. It consists now of 32 members. It was formed about a year ago. 26 major industrial corporations, 6 non-governmental organizations, including NRDC and 5 others. Thing that is different about this particular partnership is the specificity of the call for action that was released about a year ago. It is a call for a mandatory program economy-wide to cut global warming emissions, something between 10 and 30% from today's levels in the United States within the next 15 years, and 60 to 80% by the year 2050. The call for action has a number of other details associated with it, but it is different in that it does attempt to actually put together a package of legislative principles that could be enacted into law. There are a lot of challenges that remain here, and the 110th Congress is the Congress that we're in now that was first to start grappling seriously with global warming legislation. Seriously, by that I mean consideration in the committee. There was a sort of Potemkin debate on the Senate floor can be seen as nothing more than kind of a dress rehearsal for serious consideration in the next Congress. So there are lots of challenges, and those challenges are going to be heightened by characterizations of this problem as something that's going to hurt the economy, hurt consumers' pocketbooks, and one of the jobs of collaborators is going to be to demonstrate that there are huge opportunities here. I like to say that the money we spend protecting the climate is not going to go to Pluto. In fact, it's not even going to go to Saudi Arabia. We can spend money to revamp the American economy so that it's more highly energy efficient and that it relies much more on homegrown energy resources to meet our own needs. Those are going to help lower household bills, lower the cost of energy as an input to production, make our economy more resistant to changes in the price of a unit of energy. If you're twice as efficient in using a unit of energy, then you are much more resilient when that price of the unit of energy goes up. And that is something that is an opportunity that will be driven by this kind of global warming legislation. So that's sort of an outline of the prospects, and I hope some indication of why I'm optimistic that we can get the job done.
Thanks, David. Now, you laid out a menu of things that have to happen across different sectors and across different activities: investment, efficiency, transportation, smart growth. Because I'm very sympathetic with the public and the consumer sort of looking at a bewildering array of commentary on climate change and what I'm going to do as a consumer and what my oil company or my automobile manufacturer or my representatives in Congress. Does the Lieberman-Warner bill attack that menu of options? Is there one policy, or are there 100 policies?
Yeah, the Lieberman-Warner bill is the bill that was voted out of the Senate Environment Public Works Committee last December and was considered on the Senate floor in early June. It was sort of abortive consideration because there was pretty much a partisan decision to just block serious discussion, consisting initially of Republican leader objecting to the motion to dispense with the reading of the bill. This is a common motion that is made and is almost always agreed to. So they required the clerks, and there had to be several of them because this was a 497-page bill. It took about 8.5 hours to read this entire bill word for word, during which time a tornado touched down on Capitol Hill, causing some to comment that maybe this was a message from Mother Nature. But the bill itself is a comprehensive piece of legislation that addresses the entire economy, provisions for capping emissions and then bringing them down over time, and has a system of investments that are made by taking the value of the cap and trade system and auctioning off some of the allowances and creating funds that will fund energy efficiency investments, fund renewable energy investments, fund cellulosic fuels, fund a variety of other activities, advanced efficiency in manufacturing, a variety of things where essentially what you need to do is mobilize the amounts of money needed to get these changes started, and it uses the allowance value that's created by the program itself to help accomplish that.
So potentially government legislation can help set the goal or direction and move us in a particular set of directions, but Rhonda, legislation, any kind of legislation, either state or federal, is likely to have a big impact on your industry. And I think you pointed out earlier today that already you blend 17 different formulas of fuels under current regulation. Right. Looking forward, how do you read this long march from your business perspective as an energy provider and an oil and gas producer?
Well, thanks, David. Well, first of all, you know, David Hawkins has really well articulated how all-encompassing this issue is. And if I could borrow, since I'm, you know, in the PR business as well as the government affairs business, a line from our public campaigns that energy and climate is the issue of our time and it will leave no one untouched. And that really is a statement of fact. And through the lens of business, particularly an energy business, that we have a big business in fossil fuels, we certainly have an interest in this debate. And we've taken a view on this issue that we're not here to debate the science, but to the extent that governments are engaged and are supportive and want to move forward, and this legislation can be so complex, we have made a decision to engage in that. And we feel the most constructive role of business is that we can help governments understand how to put complex policies in place that business can operate in. Business can operate in market environments. Business can operate in to keep economic development going and will not create distortions or competitive issues either in the nation, between sectors, or within the globe. So it's a daunting policy. We see it as one of the most complex undertakings that we have seen that, as David mentions, is literally aimed to transform the way we produce, transport, use, and actually value energy as a society. And we will take unprecedented leaps in technology, political will, and so on and so forth. And so I think as we look at through business, what we offer probably most pragmatically is the global energy system today is one that has taken a century to build. I mean, this is the modern-day energy system. It's taken a century to construct. It is globally interconnected, and whether we kind of are conscious of it or not, it is incredibly efficient, so much so, I think, for the last three decades, a lot of us took energy for granted. It was affordable, it was cheap, it was reliable, and all of a sudden things have changed. What climate legislation will aim to do, and rightly so, I think, by the science, is what it aims to do, is transform that system that took a century to build in half that time. And not only transform it in half that time, but transform it in an environment where the system that was built to really serve a billion-plus people is really bursting at the seams to be sustainable, as about 2 billion are trying to get access to it and desire efficiencies and economic development and social well-being from it. So that does present an extraordinary challenge, but I agree with David, that doesn't mean we get on the train. And in many ways, the train's already left the station because it will take the sum of the parts. It will take extraordinary breakthroughs in technology. It will take the actions of individuals, and it will take all of it to make this happen. So getting back to how we engage, particularly on the legislation, why it's important to us, when a piece of legislation comes down like Lieberman-Warner, we look at first the practicalities. And what are the practicalities? Is the industry being treated equitably? That's the first thing we look at. How are the sectors being treated? It is getting kind of into minutiae, but are the allocations being divvied up fairly? Is the point of regulation where the regulators want to put it can actually work in practice? If you point at regulation at a gas plant, is that a facility in the real world that actually gas can come through two or three times with multiple owners and therefore could get regulated two or three times? Is there cost containment mechanisms so that the carbon market that can be very volatile, or we cannot at least foresee yet the volatility? Is there cost containment provisions so that that volatility doesn't create volatility as it runs through to consumers? The last thing we want is prices at the pump moving up and down as a carbon market moves up and down and finds its feet in what will be a pretty fledgling environment for quite some time. And so where we come in as the voice of industry is one that knows the industry from the real world, has a huge stake in putting a tax or a market on carbon, and how to help legislators develop rules that can allow business to continue to operate to meet their aims. A good example of that is what we're doing in California. I mean, California has passed legislation, their Global Warming Act, and that was very broad-based with no really rules underneath it. And we have worked with the local state authorities to bring them into our facilities, show them how the oil business operates, and construct rules that will work for business. And that collaboration has been very, very helpful in terms of the first set of rules, which are the basics of simply taking a year to work out greenhouse gas measurement and reporting, the most basic of conditions you have to allow policy to go forward, is now being built with an understanding of how business works and with an understanding how early action of business can be given credit. So that's our voice in this debate. Being treated equitably, cost containment. Another area we're concerned about, David mentioned 17 boutique fuels. Today there's 17 fuel formulations in the country. That creates some inefficiency as we try to move fuels around to markets where there is supply-demand needs. If we run on top of that 17 more renewable fuel standards or different and multiple carbon markets, we've created unnecessary complexity in a national program that can only add cost to the system. And while we applaud individual states' actions, which largely is a response to maybe not the action desired at the national level, I think at some time the states are going to have to get together and realize there has to be some harmonization. And as the Northeast REGI program is now out of the gate and California coming on board, at some point in time, individual and uniquely designed carbon markets will not be the most effective way to price carbon at the national level. And so I think it's those issues that we provide some pragmatic voice and that we are engaged in.
Thank you, Rhonda. I want to come back to what these different kind of perspectives, how we agree or disagree. But, Michael, there continues to be, if not opposition, big questions about climate change legislation inside the Beltway. But recently you wrote in Environmental Finance that governors are elected leaders most qualified to show the way on climate action and rally public support for it. What is it, or more importantly, will those governors of those 18 states, are they going to point the way towards a more comprehensive system on the legislation from your perspective?
There are two dimensions to climate policy in the United States, and they don't even interconnect. One is the federal debate about a cap and trade system that we now call the Warner-Lieberman bill. And, you know, it's, as these two have just said, one of the great innovations in that debate was the creation of this U.S. Climate Action Partnership of 32 companies who joined with the environmental groups to say, we need to do this and get this bill done, and we need a mandatory system to move things forward. The other reservoir of, you know, speaking to the theme of this panel, collaborative energy that we're going to need as a country to move climate legislation and mitigation forward is going to come from the states, I think, states and the cities. And I can say that because while this debate has been going on in Washington for the last many years about a cap-and-trade bill, there's been a whole other set of activities happening at the state and local level that's actually been kind of different. Rather than a cap-and-trade legislation being sort of the center of what's happening at the state and local level, it's really a much more diverse portfolio approach of activities that governors and mayors have been pushing forward in their jurisdictions. And it's been really interesting. There's a film, if you get a chance, I mean, if you have a pencil handy, write it down. It's called Ahead of the Curve 2, and it was done by C Studios. C Studios does a lot of the National Geographic work, it's a really nice little piece. It's about 14 minutes long. And it is so striking looking at that film because the four governors that are really highlighted in that film, two Republicans and two Democrats, essentially tell the same story about what they've done at the state level. They talk about this portfolio of actions. They talk about the practicality of what they're doing, that it's actually pretty simple. They don't talk a lot about technology, recognizing we'll need technology later, but they've gotten started in other ways. It's a lot of energy efficiency. They talk about saving money, generating jobs, building the economy of the future, economic development. They're very positive. It's so different than the DC debate, which is really a kind of, you know, cost mitigation debate. It's how are we going to lower the cost of moving forward on climate? It's a very big separation between the federal and the sub-federal systems in this country. And I think if we're going to succeed as we go forward, we're going to have to find a way to put these two things together. I mean, yes, we need a cap-and-trade system. It's absolutely right. We're on that path. Let's keep moving. We need a global carbon market. It's a way for the United States to plug in to that global carbon market. It's a way for the United States to help build the global carbon market. But we also need this kind of positive, economically beneficial, clean energy, economy is good, future kind of messaging that comes out of the state and local level. We have 27 states in this country that have designed or are designing comprehensive approaches to climate that live inside that kind of more hopeful approach. We have, 850 mayors and county commissioners around the country who have said that they would like to comply with Kyoto inside their jurisdictions. Not all of them will get there. But, they're finding those that are moving the same sorts of characteristics of the actions that they're taking, that they're saving money, they're generating jobs, they're generating economic opportunity. If we could put these two things together, I think we'll have a much better chance of actually enacting a national program in this country that makes sense, that has political support. So practically it makes sense. We'll get to more emissions, which we need to do, and we got to move fast. Politically, it would be a huge benefit if we could get governors and mayors weighing in that positive way in the national debate. The Warner-Lieberman debate, there's so much work that's been done inside Washington to move that forward. And kudos to everybody who's done that. But imagine if governors and mayors were also engaged in that debate and moving it forward. It's a really good way to get to citizens also through governors and mayors across the country. So I'm very hopeful about what's happening at the sub-federal level, and I think it can be a big part of what we do at the national level in the future. Designing how to do that is still a bit of a question, but I think it's the next wave. I think that's what we're going to see in the next year or two in the U.S.
In your experience, are those mayors and those governors advocates for what's happening on the federal level? Do you see them actively engaged in supporting some aspects of the legislation? Or
No, not because they're against it, but just because they're so active where they are. But there's something beginning to change. The governors have decided that they would like to advocate in Washington on behalf of their positions. And they are just getting organized to do that, which is interesting. And a number of mayors around the country have just joined into a coalition that is being led by a professional campaign shop in Washington now that will aim to do exactly the same thing, make sure that their voices are heard in the national debate. So it's coming.
Let me just second Michael's comments about the importance of the state and local officials, because in the national legislature, votes are decided state by state and congressional district by congressional district. That's how members vote. They vote based primarily on their constituents' interest, with some interference occasionally by bad campaign finance laws. But if you don't solve their constituent issues, you don't get their vote. And having a laboratory in a state that's showing how you can move forward is tremendously powerful in helping to solve that problem.
Now, it may be obvious in this kind of discussion or looking at climate change and legislation steps we need to take for energy producers, for utilities and oil and gas companies, but a company like yours, Leslie, Walmart, it's a global company, and it's also taking on a leadership role, and it also has the ear of the consumer or the customer. What is it? Do customers understand what Walmart is doing to be more energy efficient in their – in other words, someone going into a Walmart purchasing a compact fluorescent bulb or looking perhaps at the LED, the digital lighting in the store, do they understand that that's Walmart's commitment to climate change, or is it just another consumer experience and you're trying to lead the way the best you can?
I think one of the difficulties in the politics that we've discovered is that the customer doesn't really care very much about global warming. Now, we serve a customer that primarily lives paycheck to paycheck, 20% don't have a bank account, heavily impacted in this environmental, in this economic squeeze that we're facing. And those customers simply don't have time in their lives to care about these issues. And it's you know, for example, just on the PR side, of all the work that we've done, hopefully well received by people, we have seen no sort of benefit in our in what people think about us at the customer level about our actions, and that's not what it's about for us. I think what we've found is, and the reason why I'm optimistic, maybe because I don't spend a lot of time talking to politicians. I gave that up years ago. It's a great career move. I recommend it to everybody who can do it. They're the most frustrating people on the planet. I think what we've, we're not a regulated industry. Retail's not a regulated industry. We have a very small Washington office. We've endorsed USCAP, although we're not a member, partially because we don't have the resources to understand all the details, in a sense. But what we are is a company that is the largest private user of electricity in the United States, I think has the largest truck fleet in the United States, serves 140 million people a week in the United States and about another 40 million around the world, and has a very large global supply chain. And so what we've discovered in our own journey here is that there is no conflict between being a better business, a more efficient business, and becoming a more sustainable business. That we can collaborate, we can reduce costs, we can meet our customers' needs, we can meet our own, make our associates and employees prouder to work for us, we can improve our relationships on Capitol Hill, and do that all together. And you know, what makes me optimistic about it is that one of the great things I get to do at work is we organize this through 14 sustainable value networks, we call it. So there's one on jewelry and one on timber and one on energy. And you sit with those folks and you see the unbelievable amount of innovation and energy that's just out there to be had. And I am fully convinced that at some point we're gonna hit some rough spots in these trade-offs, but we've got a long way to go where we can make our companies more efficient, make our companies stronger, save money, build new technologies, and make a tremendous improvement. And that's kind of what we focus on every day when we go to work. How do we make our footprint more efficient? How do we use more renewable fuels? How do we reduce waste? How do we lower the price points on products so that our customers don't have to choose between an affordable product and a sustainable product, so they can come and they can have the same benefits that people who live in Aspen do of making choices, but do it when they live paycheck to paycheck. And by doing that, hope to set an example to politicians who might look at us as a pretty cost efficient and not quote-unquote progressive company and say, look, if a company like that sees this very large path forward, maybe other people can, that our customer can begin to lead a more sustainable lifestyle on their own, and that we can create the same virtuous circle with our supply chain that we've done for ourselves, so that we can meet with our suppliers and have them recognize that all the things that have worked for us, saving money, exciting our employee base, making new friends, that all those things that work for us work identically for all of them. And so if that we can set an example in that supply chain, you know, it's our sense that we can really have a very strong ripple effect globally, probably.
Now, Leslie, the customer may not know this, and some politicians may not know this, but you're really in the energy business. You're such a large consumer of energy, electricity. It puts you in the need to identify and create your own wholesale generation or buy it off the grid. What's your portfolio look like? What is it that you're doing from your business perspective to buy energy?
Yeah, the first thing we're doing is trying to make our stores more efficient. And that means for us, that's lighting and refrigeration and HVAC. It's kind of mundane, but it's the straightforward stuff that's behind a lot of the footprint in America. And so we're doing things like moving dramatically to LED lighting. And one of the great things I find at Walmart is that we're able to help bring new technologies to market. So just in the last few weeks, we've tested new LED lights that for the first time you can put up in a parking lot stanchion, and they actually work well enough to light up a parking lot. And so we find that if we can save 60% in our energy costs by switching to LED lights in the parking lots, and they pay back in two and a half years. And we're in a partnership with the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the Clinton Foundation to sort of move that procurement broader in society, which reduces our costs, reduces everybody's costs. And one of the exciting things is that we're able to work with these suppliers who are willing to make an investment in new technology, thinking we might buy it. And then if we do buy it, all of a sudden we've made this kind of available and affordable and accessible to a lot more people. So there's a lot of new technology development that is going to create a lot of jobs and create a lot of just forward momentum, I think, in the economy here. We're doing the same thing in our truck fleet, which is the other big space for us. So we have a goal to double the fuel efficiency of our fleet. We think we're going to get to 50% of that just in a few years. And so if you'll see Walmart trucks soon, they have weird-looking plastic aerodynamic fins around the side, like, you know, spoilers on 18-wheelers. We're bringing the first hybrid trucks into the fleet, and you'll see those this year. So there's a tremendous ability to save money there. On the energy side, we're believers in first and distribute. We're trying to work hard on distributed wind and solar. So we now have one of the one of the 10 largest solar installations in the world on 22 rooftops in California and in Hawaii, where we're able on day one to save money on electricity and supply about 30% of the electrical load in those stores. We're looking to see what we can do with wind. So in states where we can do that, we were shifting, particularly, and then we're also looking at distributed wind and solar. So if you go into certain of our parking lots now, you'll just starting to see a little windmill sitting on top of the parking, the light posts. And we hope to, you know, over time to be able to just get distributed wind in certain areas to fuel that. So there's just a tremendous amount of, I think, innovation going on that, you know, that I think many, many people can share that are going to make, you know, can make our, I think a lot of our installed base throughout the industry in America and around the world exceedingly more energy efficient.
Well, that menu of things that Walmart, that you say that you're doing sounds a lot like David's menu of things that have to happen. Now, here's my question, I want to start to get to some questions from the audience.
Can I just build on Leslie's point? Yeah, because I think he's really made another great example of the role of business and the importance of business, that of demonstrating, you know, these new technologies or new efficiencies in the market, you know, without legislation, without new rules, and what can be done. And our experience is a little similar as well. And, you know, we talk about, you hear a lot about there's no silver bullet, but we firmly believe that there's a diamond in the rough. And the diamond in the rough is energy efficiency and conservation, and Leslie just talked a lot about it. I mean, we've proven over 14 years that we can get up to about 30% energy efficiency within our operations. We have a business, Chevron Energy Solutions, that provides energy efficiency services, what Leslie talked about, to public institutions all over the country. And we've completed over 900 projects in schools, universities, post offices, correctional facilities. You know, the federal government is one of the largest users of electricity and energy, and we are working with them. And after 900 projects, on average, we are saving 30% on energy costs for these facilities on putting in modern HVAC, on putting in solar, on putting in fuel cells. So, again, a part of our role is proving it can be done. And if you look at what's left to gain, you know, if China could get to the energy efficiency of the U.S. that we were in 1970, that would save the equivalent of 16 million barrels a day oil equivalent, 10% of global emissions, 2.5 billion tons per year. What an opportunity for collaboration across governments, and what an opportunity for this nation, we believe, because we believe it can be done, it can be done under the economics of today. For this nation to become the nation that is the largest consumer to the largest conserver and show the rest of the world that is aspiring to what we want to become, how it can be done, and how they can leapfrog.
And so I think there's probably a lot of businesses that agree that,
that's,
you know,
right,
innovation in the marketplace can lead to a certain level,
right,
of efficiency and intensity. However, I think the hard rub here is we don't have 50 years for that to play out. We might have 10 years on depending on, you know, whose commentary you read and understand. There seems like there are some tipping points here that we have to reach. David, the legislation, all these good activities, I don't think anyone's arguing. There's a lot of innovation. There is technology. But what puts it together in the time frame that's critical so that we actually meet this environmental goal, which, frankly, at the end of the day, it is an environmental goal. It's an economic one as well.
Yeah, and let me illustrate the importance of this pace and scale. We're going to spend something like $22 trillion globally on energy investments in the next 25 years. So it's not a question of not spending money. It's a question of what we're going to spend the money on. If we spend that $22 trillion on just reproducing the existing global energy system, we're sunk from a standpoint of managing global warming. If instead we spend some of that $22 trillion more on the demand side, put more of it into slightly more expensive first-cost buildings, slightly more expensive first-cost appliances, slightly more expensive first-cost vehicles, but with operating lifetimes that are lower because they use less fuel, then we can get a handle on this problem. But to do that, we're going to have to go beyond the low-hanging fruit. We're going to have sustained economic signals that create the virtuous cycle that John Podesta was talking about. We have to, one, get these markets for efficiency investments and for advanced renewables stimulated by leveling the playing field so that today, if you want to build a solar project or some other renewables project, you're competing against an existing coal-fired power plant that has no cost associated to the CO2 that's coming out, even though the project you're trying to replace it with is one that has no CO2 coming out of it. So we're going to have to overcome that. And one of the things that putting a cap on emissions does is create that signal right away. But we don't want to solve this problem by just making the traditional energy resources so much more expensive. What we want to do is create a breakthrough along the lines of what happened with microprocessors and other things so that the prospect of an ever-growing larger market causes more and more RD&D money to be put into these advanced alternatives so that we actually bring down the total cost of energy. We've got to make the sale politically that this problem is urgent enough that we cannot wait for another Congress and another president to act, one. And we have to make the sale to those same political actors that this is doable without the political pain that the opponents are going to be saying is going to accompany it. And that's the case that has to be made. We have to make good, solid, well-communicated information about the economic opportunities here. The technology is feasible. There is a well-thought-out way to deploy this technology. There are market actors who have credibility. People like Walmart, people like projects that Chevron is pursuing say, look, this is deployable at scale in large amounts, but we have to have a supportive policy environment. And that's the case that's going to have to be made in the next 18 months to get it done.
And to get there and to be able to envision that and to have that political support, pain or no pain, and whether or not there's economic pain, which there probably will be some market losers, I don't want to point fingers, but does the oil and gas sector and NRDC or others in the NGO world who are advocating what to do, do you agree on the fundamentals? Are we even at step one in the legislation in terms of getting there? If we have a 10 or 15 year window, where are we now?
Well, I'll start on that, and Rhonda, I'm sure, will have some thoughts. It's a very good example of where collaboration has to go further in order to actually solve this problem. Right now, we have a piece of legislation that was the energy bill that was enacted at the end of 2007. It establishes renewable fuel standards for the transportation fuel industry. But those renewable fuel standards do not do what we think needs to be done with respect to greenhouse gas performance requirements. Second, the provisions include CAFE standards for vehicle efficiency. Again, they need to be further and they need to occur faster as far as we're concerned in order to get the job done. Now, I know that the vehicle manufacturers and the oil and gas industry both think that the right course of action is to let that 2007 energy bill run its course through about 2020, 2022. We think that is not going to get the job done. And so the challenge is going to be to see how we can accelerate and step up the pace and deal with some of the concerns that are causing those two industries to oppose that kind of acceleration.
Rhonda?
Well, let me just say that, in looking at that challenge between, the aspiration and the practicality. We do work to find that middle ground. And actually, we're working with some of David's colleagues at NRDC to do just that in California with their low carbon fuel standard. But just getting back from the point of view of business on just the energy bill, there's always some proponents that are going to push further than is being mandated. And there's no question in time those things will have to go further. From the point of view of industry, looking this from out of the gate towards 2020, we're looking at a mandate to put in place second generation cellulosic fuels that today are not on the market, are not at commercial scale, and the technologies that haven't come off the bench to actually get them into the market. So we look at that mandate. As we look at some of these climate mandates, I've asked my colleagues who have been a lot more experienced with me in dealing with everything going back to the Clean Air Act, has there ever been a policy that pushed business, mandated breakthroughs in technology by law to get it at scale, you know, in the commercial market? And few of my colleagues could recall anything that pushed the limits of technology from a market environment so far. So what we see in looking ahead to get to 35 billion gallons of ethanol with 21 being cellulosic as being an aggressive mandate. And if along the way, between now and 2020, disruptive technology reveals itself and we can scale up quicker and those things become competing in the market, there's no reason at all why industry wouldn't get on board with seeing that. But I think we want to get on the road, see the signposts, and kind of mobilize from there. That's kind of where we take it.
I'll point out one precedent for you, Rhonda. In 1970, the Clean Air Act required the American auto industry to achieve a 90% reduction in tailpipe emissions in four model years.
Okay.
It turned out they got an extension of two additional model years, but they got the job done. So technology forcing can work.
Right. And we support a technology forcing approach. So, I mean, there's a lot of commonality. We're probably just trying to come together and continue the dialogue on where those extremes can meet.
As everyone knows, I can never see who's out there. So if you have a question, there is a microphone underneath each of those lights, and we'll take some questions in a minute. Agreement domestically between state and federal government seems there's activity, there's a cauldron, many ideas floating around. Michael, I know you also have an interest in what happens between the United States and the international community. Do we have a similar chasm to bridge between the EU and the United States or between China and the United States? What do you see as the driving force for agreement with the United States internationally?
Good answer.
Yeah, tough answer, tough question. You know, we have so little time. I think we have a meeting in Copenhagen in December of 2009 that is supposed to be the moment that the world comes together. We have a new president arriving in the White House in the end of January of 2009. The rest of the world really wants some indication that the U.S. is going to move forward domestically with a plan that is of the scale that they all can sign on to and feel like we're actually contributing to. So there's this tough timeline. Can we convince the rest of the world in the absence of a domestic plan that might not have been created between the end of January and December of 2009, given everything else facing the next president, that we're serious about moving forward and that they should continue down the track of doing something internationally while we get our house in order during 2010 and then maybe come back together in 2010 and enact some kind of agreement. I mean, that may be the most aggressive timeline that we can hope for as a world. So it's going to be extremely, extremely challenging. There are so many issues involved, I couldn't possibly answer them. But I think, number one, if we don't get U.S. action, nothing's going to happen. You know, the world may continue to give signals, but they won't move. Critical to the globe moving forward is a U.S. federal approach that looks like it's serious. And I think part of it will be a cap and trade system. I think part of it will include you know, some kind of partnership with the state and local levels and with businesses to do the very set of practical things that Leslie's company is doing, that Chevron's doing, that every other big company in the country that is actually taking action is doing. And, you know, it's so striking. If I could just sort of go back to one of your earlier questions, you know, there is amazing similarity between what a Walmart is doing, what a New York City is doing, and what a Arizona is doing. You know, and the D.C. debate about a cap-and-trade bill appears to most of us to be sort of in the black box. We can't really understand it all. What's so useful about the very practical and understandable things that Leslie's company is doing, that New York City is doing, and many other cities that many states around the country are doing, is it's really understandable. You can get behind it. And if those leaders, CEOs and mayors and governors, come into the national debate and say that, you know, this is something that we can do and they can explain it in a clear and simple way, I think we have a much better chance of getting our domestic policy in order and then helping to influence global movement as well.
And Leslie, on that point, just briefly, could you tell us what it's like to be an international operator working in China, manufacturing or at least sourcing and purchasing goods for trade in the United States, and also having to deal with their energy and their sustainability challenges?
I think in some ways you've got kind of the same two-level debate that's in a sense going on here that's going on there. So you've got the large question about what they're going to do to control their CO2 emissions from this highly energy inefficient economy. And that's a huge challenge. For companies like us, which I think in some ways we're agnostic in – well, let me think back. For companies like us, I think what we're looking at, again, is where's our role. And so our role in China is in both our footprint, but more importantly, in the supply chain that we have there. And I think what we're seeing is a bit, as Jim Steinberg said in an earlier panel, two things happening in China. The government is beginning to talk a little bit better about this. You know, there's an increasing sort of rhetoric and they're seeing in their daily lives, places where they can't grow food, water they can't drink, air that they have trouble breathing, and so there is a much greater beginning recognition about what to do. So for companies like ours, what the commitment we've made is to work aggressively to help make our China supply chain more sustainable. So what we're doing to make this real is, you know, some of it we find you have to do it to push with your suppliers. And so we've committed we're going to have 1,000 of our suppliers in a room in October in Beijing. And we're going to say to our suppliers kind of much more clearly for the first time that, you know, that to be a long-term supplier and partner with us, you have to, one, first show us that you're complying with existing Chinese environmental laws and regulations. Because, you know, what David's colleagues and others will say is that Chinese air and water pollution laws, pretty good on paper, not so good in reality. And there's very little resource in China against enforcement. So the first thing that we have to find a way to do is to work with our suppliers to basically say, if you want to work with us, you're going to have to demonstrate to us in a much more rigorous way that you are indeed complying with the end of pipe standards that exist in China. Now, you have issues there because when you make people promise, people like us then have to show that they've kept their promise. And that requires a lot of resources. There probably isn't even sufficient auditing resources in China to be held responsible for the promises. But we've made a public commitment to do that, and we think we'll be working very aggressively to do that. And then we have to go beyond compliance. So we're going to begin to work with our suppliers, those who want to help them become initially 20% more energy efficient in their factory base working with us. So those are the places every company's got to find its way to make, you know, to apply itself into this issue. And for us, that's where we can apply ourselves, is to go to our supply chain and create expectations for them, to knowledge share with them, and to have them understand that if they want to be a ever stronger supplier to us, they're going to have to meet expectations that they may not have had to meet a few years ago. And we're pretty optimistic, you know, that will go through the system. Will that get the Chinese government to move faster on a bilateral, you know, to sort of sign the next version of Kyoto? I'm not saying that will. But I think what, you know, we've found as a Walmart is that we have to look to where our leverage is and then apply that leverage in the most effective way possible, because that's what gets the best results, and that's where it's turned out to be.
In the supply chain. How many stores in the United States?
About 7,000.
And how many in China?
Well, we have about it's about 4,000 in the United States, 7,000 worldwide. We have in China, we are the have about 400 stores, so we're the largest, what they call multinational retailer in China. But the Chinese retail base is larger. But you know, in China, it's interesting. Factories that supply domestic retailers in China by law do not export. So it's you have to deal with two completely different supply chains in your retail operation there and your global supply chain, just because of the law.
All right, do we have a question over here?
Yeah, this is a wonderful panel, so thank you for putting it together. Let me just ask you, it seems to me that there's a disconnect on the wonderful panel, and that is that when Leslie Dach talks about all that Walmart is doing, it's fabulous. When the other gentleman talks about all what the state and local governments are doing, it just sounds fabulous. And yet the default position is we need a national policy, we need Copenhagen, we need an international agreement. Maybe we don't need any of that. Maybe we don't need an international agreement because you're wasting a lot of time on going for something. Maybe the real action is at the state and local government level. Maybe Walmart's decisions are more important than an international agreement on this. And these things are happening because of economics, as you, the whole panel has said, is moving it to a more sustainable basis. And we don't need any of this infrastructure that everybody's talking about for the last 3 days. We need a national policy. We need an international policy. It seems to me it's happening very brilliantly by people like Leslie Dach and others.
Well, I can't see Ken, but I hear his voice. The I think that because of the pace and the necessity to move on a larger scale at a quicker time frame, that as good as a number of our individual efforts are going to be, that those aggregated efforts on their own aren't going to accomplish the degree of change we need in the time frame, you know, that we need to do that, that it's going to require a governmental system, a clearer price for carbon, in order to get us to get to the pace of change that the science argues that we need to have. And so my sense is that you're going to have both of these parts moving together to get to a result.
Yeah, thanks for the softball. The problem is one of scale and pace. All of the activities that are laudable that my two colleagues have pointed to are not moving us in the right direction. They're just moving us in the wrong direction more slowly. We're about 15% more emissions in the United States than we were in 1990 when we committed to try to reduce our emissions below 1990. The forecasts for 2025 in the U.S. are that our emissions are going to be somewhere like 35 to 40% higher than they are today. Globally, emissions are being forecast to be 65% higher than they are today. So, it's as though we're in Aspen deciding to take a trip to San Francisco by driving toward New York. We're not going to get there. We've got to have a policy structure that changes behavior, such as China building a couple of new coal-fired power plants every week, having investments in this country that do not penetrate the market with higher efficiency buildings, higher efficiency appliances, higher efficiency vehicles. The CAFE standards that I mentioned earlier by 2020 are required to meet 35 miles per gallon. We could be doing 60 miles per gallon technically, maybe not by 2020, but we aren't on a path to get there. And we aren't on a path to get there because the scale of the activity is not compatible with these laudable but anecdotal activities.
Can I just add one thing? I think also that there are many businesses, for example, ours, where we have tremendous confidence in our ability to sort of meet a standard more efficiently than some others might. But what you need is a sense that everybody who you're competing with is going to meet that same standard. So for us to know that everyone in retail is going to have a more sustainable supply chain, we can absorb that because we have a lot of faith that we will have a more efficient, more sustainable supply chain than our competitors. But without some sort of overall policy system, then individual companies, will make progress, but they can only make so much progress. But once you require all of our competitors, for example, in the retail business to do similar things, then that gives us actually a greater opportunity to do that in a way that we think continues to give us competitive advantage over folks, which is, in a sense, what the business has to be about.
I would just add that I think we're moving in the right direction, but more slowly, and I agree with my colleagues that you probably will need some policy action to mobilize if you truly want to accelerate this this agenda, because that's right. I mean, while there are good things happening, they are not, universal across the board. But I think it does get back to that. What we do and what is going on now in the absence of policy is proving that a chunk of this, can be mobilized. And we're on that path, and just keep it going. And it gives you, I think it gives you confidence that you can definitely cut into a chunk of this. There's a piece of that out there that is still unknown, because it requires breakthroughs we don't have in our hands today. But I think to not get on the road to discover that would be wrong.
You know, these leadership companies, cities and states are fantastic, but that's what they are. They're the early adopters, and they're not the majority. Certainly the cities aren't, and the companies aren't. The states have really moved in a big way, but there are still 20 states that haven't done anything, and among them are some of the biggest emitters in the country, like Texas, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Louisiana. There's some tough states there. So we do need national policy if we're going to get everybody moving.
Okay, let's take another question from this side.
The amount of R&D that's being spent by as a percentage of revenues in the oil, the large oil-producing industry, doesn't seem to be going to advancing the biofuels. We talked about or mentioned that we're just at the first generation of biofuels, and we need to be at the third generation to get the benefits. Why aren't they spending that kind of money when the resource costs are less than the resource cost, or the potential resource costs are less than what the costs of drilling offshore and the risks, et cetera, that are happening?
I guess I'll take that one, or
yeah.
Leslie was like, no. Well, I think if you happened to catch the session yesterday on Fueling the Future, there was a lot of discussion about the amount of research dollars going into biofuels, and it is accelerating. We have 6 programs underway in our company, and I can't speak for the whole industry, 6 programs underway in our company totally dedicated to the conversion of biomass into cellulosic ethanol, but all related to non-food. One, which is a joint venture with Weyerhaeuser, and they are a company at scale, we're a company at scale, and combining our efforts with their knowledge of plants and ours fuels to try to not just create breakthroughs at the bench, but how to scale up this in an accelerated way. Just a factoid I have, as I checked into it as a result of the same question that came up yesterday, the oil and gas industry has, I think, in the last 5 or 6 years, probably between 2002 and 2006, in the nation, there's been about $95 billion put into new energy technologies, cleaner technologies, everything from cogen to biofuels to energy efficiency. About $45 billion of that has come from the oil and gas companies themselves. So we are putting a big chunk into this as in relation to the federal government and others. But I think you are seeing the biofuels R&D accelerate as the market conditions are changing and are prompting us to get into this business.
Take another question for over here.
Well, I wouldn't dispute that we also need a national policy framework. I think that the president's ability to use the bully pulpit and moral suasion is underutilized and under-recognized. So, if the panelists had the ability to schedule an event a week in the Rose Garden, bringing forward and cajoling more leaders, whether at the state and local level or NGOs or private sector or collaborations, what are some of the ways in which you use the president's bully pulpit to identify some key leverage points for moving us in the right direction while we're also working on the national legislation and international negotiations. For example, imagine a bunch of governors stepping forward and agreeing to work on addressing the power grid issue, so we could start using more utility-scale solar and wind, for example.
I'll take a stab at it. I wrote a chapter or two on this in a few transition books lately. Having spent a large chunk of my career as a scheduler, I think that to me one of the first things from the American, from the standpoint of the American public, and whether you use Al Gore's language or Barack Obama's of, yes we can, but I think we have to instill a sense of optimism into the American public about the ability to do this, that this solution is possible, and that this solution is the best solution for America going forward in terms of security and economic development, and get the can-do, in a sense, spirit and optimism of America around the solution. I think that's a role that the president can do. I think it's a role that, the assets of the president are available to do. And I think one of the things we have to do is just flip this sense of the American public so that they just believe it can happen and that the trade-offs that they may feel today are not there, and that this is a path to a better, it's a path to a better future, not a gloomier future. Presidents, I think, can do that. How that then translates into, the way a president kind of locks people in a room and, gets a deal done. We have found in our experience, and you've been in many of these, that sometimes that works. So, sometimes Bill Clinton was able to get a deal on the budget. Sometimes that deal doesn't work. But you got to create the air cover and the political pressure to get the best possible likelihood of the deal being done. Whether any president can deliver the last bit of the deal, at least in my experience, is more difficult. But creating the air cover to make the deal much more likely, I think that's a job they can do.
There's an enormous amount of optimism about how to deal with this issue in the country. It just isn't in Washington. So I think if you could bring folks from the corporate and public sectors who have taken action on this and found good results, I think it would be tremendously useful. There's a very interesting thing called the Presidential Climate Action Plan that a man named Bill Becker here in Colorado has been putting together. And one of his lead recommendations is a first 100-day conference, exactly the sort that you described, that would bring that kind of can-do kind of spirit to the, to the discussion and make it very, very public. And a call to action would emerge. I think the other thing that you would add to that conversation would be you'd bring some of the science into, just so that everybody was absolutely clear about where we were. Because it's when you listen to the science that you get how serious this is. It's just, I have the misfortune of having listened to a number of excellent science presentations in the last couple of weeks, and they get more and more and more alarming. And if you sit through these things, you just realize that we've got to move. And so that twinning of the urgency of taking action and the possibility of doing so in an optimistic way are absolutely critical. And a president is maybe one of the few people who could do that.
Can I just say one thing? I do think it is going to take, sort of leadership, to do this, because I just, my own sense of the kind of, politics and mobilization and what we see kind of in terms of customer behavior, there's a lot of work to do to get this to move from the bottom up. David may have, in this more every day than I am, but just I'm, a little pessimistic, frankly, even with the best kind of political organizing minds and with the money that people have in advertising and grassroots, that you're going to, at a time of an economic issue, make this thing, get so strong from the bottom up that politicians are going to have to do something. My sense is that this is going to have to happen because the leadership leads. Not that the leadership follows, and that's another role that that our presidents and governors and others can do.
Yeah, I would agree completely. This problem is not going to get solved through the process of a sort of popular rebellion. It's going to take leadership, and one of the most important things that the new president can do is have an early speech that basically delivers this positive message that says, the eyes of the world are on the United States, and that's good news because the United States can actually decide its own fate with respect to how it's going to move forward on tackling this problem, and the rest of the world is going to be responsive. and the things that the United States needs to do to tackle this problem are not going to be bad for the economy. They're going to be good for the economy. They're going to create markets that don't exist now, and they're going to create opportunities for technology leadership that the United States can use in markets around the world. And we have a choice of either getting ahead of the curve or staying where we are, and the time has come to act, and this is something that could be a tremendous positive benefit in addressing a lot of bad news things. We can make our energy supply more secure by relying more heavily on domestic resources that are renewable. If we have a fleet of buildings that are highly efficient, there's no foreign leader that can disrupt that. If we have a fleet of vehicles that are highly efficient, there's no foreign country that can interfere with that. If we have the wind and the sun that shine on America and blow across the plains that we're using to tap, that's something that we have control over, not somebody else. These are things that the market will bring out if we have a supportive policy environment, and that's what Congress needs to do, is to provide that.
Can I just add 2 cents? I mean, we have principles of climate policy that kind of underpin, no matter if you're looking at tax cap and trade, performance standards, whatever. Probably the most important of these principles that we believe in that's vital is transparency. Transparency of what these policies mean, what they're going to mean to the public, is vitally important. The last thing, I mean, it's understood by everyone in the policy community that the fundamental premise of a carbon tax or a cap and trade or a carbon market is to put a cost on carbon, which is putting a cost on energy in society and therefore fundamentally raising the cost of energy. Albeit it could be in the short term, it could be in the long term, but that is by design. I think policymakers owe it to the American people to be completely honest about the risk, completely honest about what these policies do, and completely, I think, inspiring about a path forward. But I think it's going to take all those three things. But we still have policymakers out there that will say in the public domain, I support cap and trade because it's not going to raise the prices at the pump. And so these misconceptions can cause chaos at a time if you start going down the path of a very sophisticated policy that the public don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know if it helps or hurts a president when that new president makes that first television address if gasoline is $5 or $6 a gallon. It remains to be seen.
Well, let me just say, one of the things that the president and the cabinet need to explain is the difference between energy prices and energy bills. You know, we don't actually value, as consumers, gallons of gasoline. We value mobility. And if we have a way of getting more miles out of a gallon of gasoline, I don't know about you, but when I go to a gas station these days, the Prius owners are smiling. You know, the impact of higher prices on consumers is buffered if you have higher technology that lets you get more out of that gallon of gasoline, the same with kilowatt hours. So, yes, we cannot be telling the public that the price per gallon is going to be lower or no higher, but we can say if this is done correctly, the energy bill, which is actually what comes out of your checking account, the energy bill that you see can be lower.
One last question, a quick one, if there's someone over on the... Okay.
This is more of a statement just about Walmart. I heard you say loud and clear that your customers are not being affected by your choices on the environment, or at least 20% are not hearing it and can't hear it, and I understand that. I'm thankfully part of the 80%, and I'm hearing it loud and clear. And the esteem with which I hold Walmart has gone up exponentially because of their activities with the environment. And I just wanted to state that publicly.
Leslie, I said you have the last word.
I appreciate that. That's a good thing. I think to the point about the customer, we've tried a lot of ways to convince our customer that kind of buying more green is a good, is the right thing to do, because we feel that, competitively we could establish that. And one of the things that is kind of, I wouldn't say quite frustrating, but is a realistic piece of realism I've had to understand is the large, is the difficulty of doing that. And what we've found the places, there are kind of three places so far where you can convince a customer who is living tough in this economy. One is reducing their own energy prices. So if you can help convince people that they can take a stand, you know, make an expenditure today to reduce their own energy prices, you have a chance of, you know, of doing that. Secondly is packaging to some degree, because I think that's a symbolic thing to people. They see less packaging. They feel like they're, it doesn't affect the product's quality. They're going to save some money, but they feel like they're making a personal, you know, could do something personally. And third, but much lesser degree, is, you know, sort of organic food in very narrow segments. But it's just a difficult thing to get the American consumer to make those, you know, choices, which is why we've had to fall back on this. We have a strategy that basically says, we're not going to make you make the choice. We're going to drive the price points down so that when you come into the store, you don't have to pay more for a more sustainable product. And we will try and invest more in educating you. So, you know, we have sold now, you know, and it is just an anecdote, but 192 million compact fluorescent bulbs. So that saved our customer about $6 billion just in the electrical costs of those bulbs. So if we could be more effectively educate people about those sorts of things, you know, then they will, you know, they will shop differently.
Collaboration is critical. Rhonda, Michael, David, Leslie, thank you very much.